Welcome to the Behaviorist Book Club. We are a community of practitioners focused on helping your clients achieve meaningful and socially significant behavior change. This is your host, Matt Harrington.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Behaviorist Book Club podcast. I'm your host, Matt Harrington, and I say, let's just get going. So we're going to be talking about today the article Paying for Supervision, Barriers, Solutions, and Opportunities by Crystal Slanzi and Tyra Sellers. This is published in Behavior Analysis and Practice, and articles like this are one of the reasons why I've really come to love Behavior Analysis and Practice as a journal. I feel like they're always focused not only on noting a challenge, but also finding an opportunity and a solution. And this article, I think, exemplifies that perfectly. So this article essentially is talking about this inherent struggle with certification that I had, that you had, and that frankly some people have more than others based on their financial situation. Let's all sit back and acknowledge the fact that the ability to get to certification and pay for your certification hours, there's some inherent financial privilege in that because many people simply cannot afford it. I was on Facebook the other day and I saw that people were charging $50, $60, $100 per hour for supervision. And, you know, I'm not somebody to tell them that they need to lower their prices or anything like that, but that's a steep cost. And for many people, that's simply not accessible. I hate doing public math, so forgive me, but, you know, if you're talking about 10% of 1,500 hours, that's about 150 supervised hours. And then you multiply that by $100 per hour, and you're getting to $15,000. For supervision, this is on top of the master's degree that you just paid for, not to mention the certification costs and the fact that this is going to happen while you're living your normal life. It's just a hefty bill to pay to get certified. I think it's worthwhile to point out that behavior analysis isn't independent in the field of mental health or psychology to have people paying for supervision. I know oftentimes in mental health, you're paying for supervision as well, licensed mental health counselors and things like that. But it doesn't mean it's, you know, the best case situation. And I don't think that there's really a perfect solution. I don't have the statistics on it, but it's worthwhile to point out that a lot of people get their supervision for free through their workplace as a registered behavior technician. However, there's a lot of people where being a registered behavior technician just isn't possible because of the time that it takes, you know, quitting your other full-time job because of the pay cut. Many people are coming from teaching jobs where they're expecting to make $45,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year, and an RBT position typically makes closer to $30,000, $40,000, or $50,000, so the pay cut may not be possible. A lot of people took their certification course online, and now they have to go in person and change up their life because of the rural area that they live in. That might not be possible either. It's just not a great situation, just feasibility. But also there's a little bit of limiting factors that come along with getting your supervision through your workplace. And this is coming from somebody who got their supervision through their workplace. Just off the top of my head, some struggles that you're going to come into is limited access to high quality supervision. I kind of had a weird situation where my supervision was acquired from two different hospital units and a clinical setting that I was at. And I can be the first one to tell you that depending on what setting I was in, depended on the quality of supervision. In one place, I had this great, high quality, interactive, engaging supervision where we talked about the clients and engaged in that learning active process. And the other one was more of check the boxes. It really differed depending on location, and it created a little bit of a whiplash for my supervision experience. Really solid, really solid, really solid. You know, totally out of nowhere, check the box, sign the paper, you're good to go. you also don't really get a wide range of skills. Let's say you're taking your supervision, you get all 1,500 to 2,000 hours at a single supervision site. That makes sense. A lot of people do that over the course of a year and a half to 2 years at one job as a technician. They get all their supervision hours. That means it's possible that you've only ever practiced in one setting, and then you're going to start applying for jobs when you're a behavior analyst, and suddenly the world is your oyster when it comes to when it comes to opportunities. And so you may not feel prepared. I run into this a lot when I talk to school behavior analysts. They say, you know, they don't really want to stay in the school setting. They don't love the school setting, but they got all their supervision. They worked as a teacher before that and then a behavior specialist to get their hours. All they know is the school setting. They feel like they can't transition to clinic because they don't have any relative experience. So there's another challenge. And finally, you're going to get limited exposure to styles of behavior analysis. Now, when I say styles, I'm going to go a little bit into that, like, don't talk about that stage, because we're talking about things like compassionate, trauma-informed ABA, you know, the blank ABA. And the reason I point this out is because I typically at a clinical setting, most supervisors are going to program in a similar way. Typically, you'll have a bunch of supervisors, you know, who are programming PFA and SBT. And so if you're collecting supervision from that site, you're going to get a lot of experience in PFA and SBT. You might not get the experience you need in automatically maintained behavior or augmented competing stimulus assessments, for example, or vice versa. You're going to kind of focus on one thing and not the other. All of these barriers, by the way, are addressed by paying for supervision. And it's that hard reality of, are you going to pay and potentially get a higher quality supervision experience, or are you going to take the free route, go through your work, and get a potentially lower quality, but not always? I think my supervision experience for the most part was pretty good, and I didn't pay a dime, but it depends on where you're at. We'll talk about what I would do at the end of the episode in terms of supervision, but it's worthwhile to acknowledge that this paying for supervision thing, it's much more complicated than just, you know, a $600 bill every month. You get to these real life, like, in these situations, what do I do? Cost-benefit analysis of potentially getting higher quality supervision or kind of just getting the minimum and getting by. So whenever we're talking about payment for something, there's going to be a little bit of a conflict of interest. And, you know, you could call it a double standard because in one breath, our ethics code tells us not to accept payment, you know, from caregivers outside of our normal contracted services. And then in another, they say paying for supervision is fine. And the reality is, because of all those reasons I listed above, there's no real good solution to this challenge. So we are allowed ethically to charge people for supervision or to, you know, pay for a supervisor. And I think that's fair. You know, time takes money to purchase and it's valuable. So it makes sense to charge for supervision. But as soon as you put a paycheck at the end of it, things get messy. And that's primarily what these authors want to point out. We're going to go through the five challenges that they identified, and then we're going to go through their potential solutions, and then they go through a little bit of learning opportunities too. So once again, one of the reasons why I like BAP, they're always talking not only about the challenge, but also the solutions and what can come of it. So without further ado, let's get rolling in the challenges and solutions. Challenge number one, the supervisor works for the trainee. Now, I know what you're thinking, but Matthew, in the ethics code, it specifically says the trainee cannot be the boss of your supervisor. It does say that. And then it says you can also pay for your supervision. In a way, whoever is providing the payment, the other person is contracted to them. And it creates some sticky situations. For example, let's say you're the supervisor and you realize that your trainee hasn't mastered the necessary task analysis skills to become proficient at using a functional analysis. if you give them that feedback and you say, I can't sign off on this paper, I don't think you're ready, you can't demonstrate to me the skills for our functional analysis, what if that person doesn't pay for that supervision hour? Heck, what if they say, screw you, I'm going to go find another person on Facebook? You just lost $150 an hour, or $100 an hour, or whatever you're charging. In this inflation economy, where it costs $100 just to go to the grocery store and back. So the fear of losing payment is 100% a real conflict here. And so the supervisor may feel the need to water down their feedback, give it less frequently, overall reduce the quality of their supervision to save for some feelings. That's just not a good situation for the trainee and for those future clients. A potential solution, right? Clear communication. And you're going to hear me say that a lot, but that's really what it comes down to. Before starting that relationship, you sit down with your trainee, the trainee sits down with their supervisor, and you just have a real talk about these boundaries, these struggles that are going to come up. And they say, all right, we have a clear contract. These are the things that result in you getting a supervision hour. And these are the things that result in me getting paid. Challenge number two. Payment schedule is based on meeting time. This is another kind of like flowing from that last one. The solution partially was paying for time, but we can't really just pay for time because there's a lot of errors if it's just 1 hour of, you know, time equals 1 hour of supervision. Let's take, for example, we're paying based on meeting time, right? That's one of the challenges that can come up. And when we're paying for meeting time, the trainee comes into the supervisor's office. The supervisor is finishing typing on Central Reach. They're going to do a note. They got three things going on. And finally, they rustle in their drawer. They pull out an article and they say, all right, let's do it. And the trainee says, yep, I got the article. I highlighted it. And the supervisor says, great, go ahead and, you know, spit back the information to me. And the trainee is like, I thought we were going to discuss it. I thought it was more of a back and forth. Supervisor says, I didn't really have a chance to read it, but this will still count as long as you're giving me that information. And those words, this will still count, is absolutely to the detriment of the trainee, because it shows that the supervisor wasn't prepared, and what they're looking at is a subpar supervision experience, at least for that hour, that they're still going to have to pay $50, $60, $100 for. So if payment is suffice to get your contracted, you know, your supervision hours, then your quality is going to suffer. After all, as a trainee, the reality is you're just trying to reach that BCBA certification. So you may end up putting your concerns to the side, sweeping them under the rug, and paying for that supervision, even if the quality isn't great. For the solution, let's consider competency-based supervision goals. Now, this gets a little funky, and there's not a really clean way to do this in every situation, but you can set checkpoints and say, hey, when we get to 300 hours of field work required, that means you'll have 30 hours of supervision or whatever the calculation is. At that point, I want you to have these skills mastered. This is the supervisor talking to the trainee. These are the things that we're going to check. And as you master those skills, that's when we're going to set up payment. So you can still make it commensurate for your time, but you can also set up these competency-based skills. The trainee isn't going to get the hours, and supervisor isn't going to get paid. Rolling through the next few a little bit faster, challenge number three, gaps in supervision time. This can happen if simply the payments become too much. Let's say you're working with an RBT, a trainee, and that trainee gets their hours cut because a client discharges. All right, well, instead of bringing home $3,000 a month, now they're bringing home $1,500. One of the things they're probably going to have to cut in their budget to afford life is probably supervision. So if that happens, you can hopefully have things arranged in advance for potentially lower payment schedules, lower fees based on need, if you're able to, you can set it up to where, all right, let's do less hours, but still meet monthly. There's a lot of different levers to pull, but the reality is when money's in the picture, you gotta buy food before you get supervision hours. Quick pause here for a second so I can tell you about something that's going to benefit you massively. You can probably tell that I read a lot of research just to produce this podcast and also just to keep my head above water in my clinical work. See, I'm always looking for the most efficient, quickest, and most practitioner yet also evidence-based way to solve the clinical challenges in front of me. However, as you know, quick and research don't always go hand in hand, and that's why I created the Solving Clinical Challenges with Research course to teach you an efficient 20 to 30 minute method to access, utilize, and identify research articles as well as summarizing them so that you can have the best information possible to solve your clinical challenges. This 2 CEU course is completely free for podcast listeners. Just go to behavioristbookclub.com/solving. behavioristbookclub.com/solving to get your free 2 CEU course. Back to the podcast. Challenge number 4, trainees and supervisors may work in different locations. This can get funky for a number of different reasons. There's two off the bat. The first one, easy. Is there consent to supervise their clients? Right? If a caregiver says, no, I don't want my child's information talked about outside of this small team, then it's not going to be a great relationship with the supervisor because the trainee can't actually tell the supervisor anything. So we need to be aware that if you're going to work in a different setting, you got to have the correct consents in place, and a good supervisor should be able to help the trainee facilitate that. The second issue that gets a little more funky is, what if the style of the supervisor is vastly different than the style of the trainee's workplace? So consider this. The trainee works in a place that does a lot of three-step prompting, a lot of escape, extinction, and follow-through, and a lot of isolated functional analysis, and their clinic director thinks that synthesized contingency analyses are stupid. I've seen it happen. I've met people who think that. Okay, what if the supervisor is an expert in PFA and SPT methodology, and they're looking at these cases in a more sent-forward, proactive approach? There's probably going to be some issues there, right? The supervisor is going to be talking to the trainee about the PFA and SPT approach. They're going to be suggesting PFAs. They're going to be suggesting the shaping up of the CAB branches. At the same time, the trainee probably won't actually be able to implement those because of the restrictions in their supervision site. So you got to understand, if there's a big restriction if you don't work with that person or at least have a similar style of supervision and ABA to the trainee's ultimate work site. The solution here is just communication and potentially role playing for some of those skills. I talked about kind of a thing where the clinical director thinks that, you know, PFA is stupid. It can also be simpler, right? What if you're working in behavioral feeding and the supervisor wants to give you experience in functional analyses for other challenging behavior, right? You just don't have a place to practice. Role playing comes in handy there. In the moment, feedback absolutely comes in handy. And finally, challenge number 5, trainee chooses to have more than one supervisor. I actually prefer this. To be totally honest, cards on the table. If you're able to, I think the more supervisors you have, the better, because it gives you a more diverse look at the supervision experience. Now, a caveat to that, if one supervisor is amazing and the other one sucks, cut the other supervisor, right? You don't want to be paying for bad supervision. But if you have two high-quality supervisors and they have a completely different outlook on these situations, perfect. That's exactly the type of experience that you want as a trainee to become a high-quality behavior analyst who can look at a situation from multiple different perspectives. However, in that scenario, you're going to have to communicate really clearly, and the supervisors are going to have to communicate really clearly. Imagine, for example, if one supervisor takes, you know, 2 hours to explain the latency-based functional analysis, and then the next supervisor says, you know what we should go over for the next hour and a half? The latency-based functional analysis. It's just wasting time. Solutions are potentially a shared Google Drive, some type of checklist that both supervisors share, something to communicate, hey, last week I worked on this, so either follow up with me on that or work on something else if I have competence in it. So once again, clear communication, good contracting saves the day in most of these scenarios. So, five challenges, five potential solutions, some learning opportunities through and through, mainly focused on communication and dealing with hard things. So what's the big takeaway? The short answer is conflicts of interest are unavoidable. You're not going to be able to dodge them, especially when payment gets involved. They're like sequence effects in a reversal design. No matter what you do, B is going to come after A, and A is going to come after B. They're just going to happen. However, we can work to minimize them. With clear communication, really solid contracting, you can at least dodge the majority of these challenges and then be well set up to prepare for future challenges when they come up later on in the future. Overall, my biggest suggestion for this is to be selfish. Now, I'm going to speak specifically to the trainees here, and if you're a supervisor, I want you to listen and potentially provide this advice to your supervisees as well. Supervision is, in my opinion, the time in your behavior analytic life to be as selfish as possible. For the next 1,500 to 2,000 hours, you need to be ruthless and calculated in how much information you gain and who you gain it from. It's not the time to delay on a job switch because you don't want to hurt somebody's feelings. I want you to ruthlessly leave a job that you think you're getting poor quality supervision in immediately and go find one where you can get high quality supervision. Even if there's a drop in pay, the amount of confidence that a high quality supervision experience sets you up to have, you'll instantly make back that money when you go to start interviewing for BCBA jobs. I know that it can be tempting to just stick with the status quo, stay in one place, just do your thing, stay in your comfort zone. But the best thing I did in my supervision career is I got supervision in a severe behavior unit, a behavioral feeding unit, and a regular old clinic setting. And those three experiences, even now, have made me a vastly more competitive interviewee and potential hire because I know simply more about behavior analysis because I've seen more behavior analysis. If you're working in early intervention and you've been doing it for 3 years and you're looking at another 2 for supervision experience, consider switching. Try a group home. Try sexual behavior. Try, you know, the school. Try something to get you out of that comfort zone and to learn a different experience. And if you have a bad supervisor, kick them to the curb. It's all about you. It's all about your learning, especially if you're paying for it. It is all about you becoming the best behavior analyst so you can serve these clients way better in the future. So there you have it. That's the end of our podcast. It would mean the world to me if you commented or shared or however you're interacting with this content. Subscribe if you're on a podcast platform. If you're available, give a review to this podcast. Give it 5 stars if you love it. Give me feedback if not. I read every single one and it does a ton to boost the visibility of content like this in the overall algorithm. If you want to continue engaging with the Behaviorist Book Club, the best place to go is the ABA Cafe Facebook group. You can find it just by typing in the ABA Cafe into your Facebook search bar. It is a group of research-minded practitioners engaging and collaborating together to become better behavior analysts through our application of practitioner-focused research. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next one.